The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Well-intentioned as they may be, ultimately it's disastrous in its results. But even recent history, as recent as 08 and 09, is easy to forget because people continue to forget the past. And I think this is one of the prudent reasons, this is one of the primary reasons, this is one of the essential reasons to own gold. People forget the past.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, Dave, while you this weekend were finally doing the last of your Ironman races, I was up in the mountains at a gold mine with a friend of mine who's a partner in it. And tell me first about the race. I mean, were you pleased with the time?
I was. You know, there's different elements in every day and you prepare the best you can and you never know what the day is going to bring. So it could be hot, it could be cold, it could be windy. You know, those conditions you're not in control of. So you just bring your best to the game.
Okay, but I've got a question for you. Okay, because we talked about this a couple of years ago. You really, really trained for that first one because, of course, that's always the unknown. You're now getting close. I'm not going to mention times, but you're now getting close to where you, if you trained like you did 2 years ago, could probably shave off 15 or 20 minutes and get into times that mainly the pros see.
And I don't know that I want to commit that much. So, yeah, I mean, yeah. The reality of business life and family life and factoring in training, I've figured out how to cheat as much as I can on the training aspect and get as much as I can with as little input as possible.
And still have a family with four kids and a wife.
Well, and not have a heart attack when I go do a race.
Yeah.
You do still have to train. There's no way around it. But truly, the first year was a little obsessive. And I think I'd have to go back to that to break into a super competitive time.
Well, while you were doing that, I was up at about 12,000 feet with a friend of mine. He has purchased a gold mine that right now is inactive here in the Durango area. But, you know, if gold hits 2,000 or gets above 2,000, he understands that that's an asset that he'll be able to sell for a whole lot more than, you know, what he bought it for. But it was interesting being up there, Dave, as I realized just how rugged it is. I had to get out of the Jeep a couple of times. In fact, he told me, he says, this is where we don't wear our seatbelts. And I looked at him and I said, why? And he goes, well, you may have to get out of the Jeep really quick. And, you know, as you look down the cliff, I understand what he's saying, but I had no idea. I kept thinking, okay, do I go over the front? Do I go over the back? How exactly do I get out of a Jeep that's falling off of a cliff? But it made me think, okay, as we went through the tailings and we're trying to find gold ore that was left over from the mine, it really hit me. All over the world, people have done this for thousands of years. The difficulty of extraction, the difficulty of getting up to that terrain. There really is something about the longevity of gold. I know we get sometimes discouraged about the manipulations in prices, but honestly, Dave, if you look at it, gold has that lasting value. It still buys what it did thousands of years ago per ounce.
Well, and you see it in the news today with sanctions being reintroduced here in recent days with Iran. You know, the imports for gold are huge. And wherever you see chaos, you see the need and demand for gold increase.
Well, did I read right that in the Wall Street Journal, they were saying the central bank in Iran has minted 60 tons of gold into coins and are encouraging their people to go into that instead of other currencies.
And you see the same thing in Turkey, where, you know, you've had currency chaos, interest rates continuing to rise, the value of the lira continuing to fall, and to stabilize things. There is this natural demand, this natural inclination towards gold ownership. So Turkish demand for gold, Iranian demand for gold, Venezuelan demand for the demand for anything, frankly. I mean, you have the Brazilian government closing the borders and not allowing Venezuelans to come across the Brazilian border because of it's such a flight of people. Desperate times require a rethink on everything. But one thing that seems to be repeated throughout history is the importance of gold in those periods of pressure.
And you mentioned Venezuela. I mean, it goes without saying that gold's up 3.1% this year in Venezuelan currency. So I guess gold's not going down everywhere. Now, you know, there was a story July 18th that a South Korean salvage team discovered a 113-year-old wreck. It was a Russian warship And they think there may be 200 tons of gold in there. And, you know, Jim Grant wrote on that. He said, you know, at first he said, my shoulders just drooped. It was like, oh gosh, another darn thing. There's 200 tons more of an unwanted asset destined to hit the markets. And then he said, on second thought, I view the story as proof of concept. What other monetary metal could hold its value for more than a century while underwater? Cycles of investment fashion are forever changing, he says. Gold, real money, lasts. Now, I think we should talk. There are two economies right now, Dave. There's the value economy, which nobody remembers anymore, when you actually went and bought a stock because it had value, or you bought a gold mine because it had value. Maybe it's future value. That's one economy. The other economy is this very, very short-term algorithmically traded economy that really doesn't look for value. They just look for momentum and algorithmic trends.
And we've talked about fear of being left out, the fear of missing out, yeah. FOMO.
FOMO.
And I was in Denver this last weekend staying with a friend, and there was this sense that the real estate market in Denver is so hot, you just have to buy something. And I know this neighborhood. I know the neighborhood because it's the neighborhood I grew up in.
Mm.
And these are very, very modest houses. And the idea that these very, very modest houses, both in terms of the size, the style, the material quality, the size of the lot, the location within the metropolitan complex, that these should be north of $500,000 is patently absurd.
Right.
And yet they sell for $500,000. Almost like $500,000 doesn't mean anything anymore. So, you know, you mention the rate of increase in bolivars for gold and being up 3,000,000%. Well, what are we talking about really when mm-hmm. we're talking about price? I mean, we have a reference that goes back to real things. And I think you begin to lose perspective when you don't have real things in the equation. Because even a house, which is a real thing, because it's denominated in fiat currency, this is not merely an issue of supply and demand. Something is wacky. Something is very unsustainable. You know, the replacement value of those houses is probably one quarter of the asking price.
Right.
And yet that's the current price structure. Well, what does the current price structure mean? It is what it is until it isn't.
Isn't it always created? Isn't all of the inflation of assets created by debt, just large amounts of debt? I look at the Chinese right now. Now, you know, 10 years ago, we had the Lehman crisis. That's what we call it. And that was created with too much debt. Now we have the Chinese sort of in the same boat. We're talking trillions and trillions of dollars under the asset management of a single bank in China.
Yeah, one more thing on debt, because it's not just overseas. I talked to a guy here in the office, and he asked me this question last week. He said, can the average person afford $60,000 to $90,000 for a truck? And yet the average person walks in off the street and buys a truck any day of the week for between $60,000 and $90,000, because that's what a truck goes for these days. And you think, well, yes, that's a lot of money. Who on a normal salary can just plunk down that money?
That's a lot of debt.
That's the point, is that we can do a lot of things with a lot of money that's not ours. And ultimately, it just comes back to how much of our current income are we willing to spend and give away, becoming some sort of a debt slave.
Okay, but what happens when cracks start forming in that debt, like we saw 10 years ago? It seems that we're set up for that again, but it may not happen here. It may start in Asia.
Well, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I mean, you can look at this on any cyclical time frame. Haorong Asset Management is a Chinese bank, and it was set up in 1999 to bury the bad loans of a previous expansionary phase in China. Okay, this is just to illustrate what you're saying. It's still around, that institution, and it has an expanded financial market role. It's not just a bad bank or a special purpose vehicle to carry bad loans. It's become a very significant bank. But originally it was created to offload the bad loans of ICBC. This is China's largest commercial bank, and frankly, the largest bank in the world, if you're counting assets, $4 trillion in assets.
$4 trillion.
Yeah,
wow.
And today, that little bank, Haorong Asset Management, it's publicly traded. They have strategic investors such as Goldman Sachs and Warburg Pincus. And there's news that you may have seen if you follow the financial media at all, where the chairman was placed under investigation. He was arrested in April.
Yeah, but what about the co-chairman? I heard that he just sort of disappeared strangely while he was on vacation. Where? In France?
Right. He went to France and mysteriously died while on a sightseeing trip. It's, you know, again, it's, the bank has a reputation, and it has a reputation going back to what it was intended to do in 1999.
It was
the cleanup
job. Just bad paper, right?
Well, and the cleanup job, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind when I think of like the cleanup job, do you remember seeing the movie 3 Days of the Condor? You've got this analyst, and this analyst is paid to read books and write out plots, which might actually be used. Those plots could develop into sort of an espionage and counterattack or whatever, you know, where a country is going to try to undermine or change or, you know,
sort
influence
of thought
an election.
Or they're thought experiments,
yes,
basically,
exactly.
Different scenarios.
And so he hands in his paper, you know, about what these novels that he's been reading inform him on. And he gets too close to the truth because there is one of these things actually in motion, and it's being orchestrated by someone above him, and it's going to be revealed. So there's this cleanup job that's needed, and they send in a crew, and the crew is there to not only take him out, but then eliminate any evidence that anything bad ever happened.
Do you think that happened to the co-chairman for Hurong Asset Management, or can you point fingers?
Well, I think the whole existence of the bank is like that, only it's not about espionage. It's just about, let's make a bad story go away, and let's get the cleanup guys in there. We did this with Maiden Lane 1 and 2. When we had bad bank loans here in the United States, what we did is, during the 2008-2009 financial crisis, we created these special purpose vehicles. We took bad loans, put them in there, and it allowed for banks to have prettier balance sheets. And it's just, you know, the reputation at Hurong Asset Management is for handling the worst quality paper and for being the most aggressive in terms of their business practices. There is a Chinese newspaper which described them as doing bad business as a bad bank. Mm. And you might recall, again, we have a history of creating our own special purpose vehicles, but these are literally balance sheets which are created to become the receptacle for all toxic paper. The unlovely assets, the things that you don't really want to talk about, the things that don't have a two-way market, no one wants to buy them at any price. But if you marked them to market, you could destroy the solvency of the financial institutions. You just move them off balance sheet.
It's reminiscent of Enron, but that was a private organization. That wasn't a national bank.
Well, and here's the difference. When you've got backing from the government, you can do that stuff. Enron didn't have the backing of the government,
right,
and they got into hot water. They created these special purpose vehicles named after a whole host of Star Wars characters. And they took all of their bad bets, moved them off the balance sheet, and then showed Wall Street how pretty and beautiful they were. And it was just half the story. What we have in China is only half the story because these banks still exist and they're being used very aggressively. So, you know, while the bank has attempted to convert itself to a proper source of sort of private and commercial finance, a normal bank, it's also continued to be an aggressive buyer of assets, which are at or near default.
Mm-hmm.
And the role is critical. The role is critical to the Chinese when economic growth is so heavily dependent on credit expansion. Because keep in mind, when you're expanding credit, what are you doing? You're issuing loans. You're issuing new loans. And if your goal is to just push as much money out into the system as possible, then there is no way for all of those loans to have proper due diligence, for them to have been vetted in an excellent or professional. Where is the procedure and protocol to make sure that these are good loans going out the door?
Just like subprime back in the mid-2000s.
That's right. So the challenges that they're facing, highlighted by one of our regular guests, Michael Pettis, he lives there in Beijing. You've got equity, you've got real estate financing, and they do that on longer terms. And this is a funding mismatch because most of the borrowing from the bank that gets turned into loans for external use are on much shorter terms.
They're short-term loans for things that they're going to be hanging out there for a long time.
But it's a classic banking mismatch. I mean, we do the same thing here in the United States, borrow short, lend long. But you're talking about a portfolio of incredibly questionable quality, right? As recently as 2014, this bank was used to clean up a product which had blown sky high by ICBC. It was a high yield product, and they bailed out the investors and bailed out the bank by shuffling off all the product mix into Harong Asset Management.
This is a type of asset that would be called junk here in America, right? Like a junk bond.
Sure.
It's a junk equity.
And that's what they're doing still. They're aggressively buying junk paper. They're aggressively providing bridge loan financing for distressed companies. So what's at stake? Well, you've got the chairman. This is a guy that's been close to a lot of deals over the last 20 odd years, nearly 20 years. And a lot of those deals are purposefully opaque. Hmm. There is a reason he will not see the light of day.
A little like the co-chairman who didn't see the light of day.
Exactly. Already slipped on a banana peel in France. But within China, you've got these strong economic numbers. Let me qualify that, because these are strong by comparison to the United States, but they have been in a decidedly negative trend for a number of quarters. We have declining growth rates, which are now the norm in China. But you've got these economic numbers, and they are dependent to a degree on the ability of financial vehicles like the one mentioned here to clean up and pretty up the pig, so to say.
Well, you remember the chess master. He was master for many years. He was actually king of the universe of chess, Garry Kasparov. Garry Kasparov comes from a controlled society, and he had a quote, probably looking backwards at his Russian background, but also looking forwards to just the management that's required when you've already tried to manage something. Here's his quote. "When a managed economy begins to fail, the only direction is to manage it more and more. It's how democratic socialism leads to repression."
Well, and maybe we need to keep that in mind in terms of there being a natural consequence and the movement towards repression here in the United States. We have a younger generation who's somewhat falling in love with this idea of democratic socialism. Right.
Right? They've never seen the imbalance.
Right, right. But I guess the point here is that it does relate to China, in that you have higher and higher degrees of management which are necessary, and Harong has played a key role in covering over the blemishes and mistakes, the mars left by credit expansion.
Let me ask you a question, though. Okay, if you're having to kill co-chairmen and you're having to, you know, mute the chairman of these organizations, are we getting close to something? You know, I mentioned cracks in the system. You don't really have to do that when everything's running hunky-dory, do you?
Clearly, the excuse in China is that they're cleaning up a mess, and the mess is not within the banking organization itself, but they would point to corruption and graft and things of that nature. And while I don't discount that at all, I think that's a very common occurrence within China. We've talked about the 59.5 rule, where forced retirement, you begin to see quite a bit of corruption and graft, where all of a sudden staplers and pencils and everything else go missing as you're walking out the door in retirement. That's kind of a mention pay, and others have talked about that on the commentary with us before. But where are we at now? We're at the outer reaches of global credit excess. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and you begin to see the operators, they're under pressure. Managers disappear.
That's what I mean.
I think it speaks to a loss of control by the central planners. I marvel at how time wipes away the memory of so many people. Maybe that's a little bit of a rabbit trail philosophically, but it's not like we haven't seen this before. Forced mergers are likely, I think, as we look at China. Forced mergers within the banking system, within the medium-sized banks, within the small banks, within the local and regional banks, those who have been closest to the credit spigots and have been involved in the misallocation of borrowed capital. I think what Pettis is really capturing in some of his analysis is the complete socializing of credit.
Where the government just owns it all.
That's right. And so for those that have come to the conclusion that China is maybe the new bastion of economic activity, perhaps the greatest 21st century example of the free enterprise system, I think this needs to be a reminder. The reminder of the importance of ideas, of ideological commitment, and of the reality that socialism is an offshoot to communism and is an expression of command and control dynamics, is anything but an expression of free enterprise and of pure capitalist economic activity. China is ratcheting up control. Harong, once a cesspool for dumping bad debt, is now having its own financial issues. And what do the financial markets of China look like over the next 10 or 20 years? Are they more open or are they less open? Do you have more free market dynamics in play or less? Do we see them having a greater international footprint or less? And these are questions that come to mind, because if China's place in the global economy and if China's place geostrategically is going to improve and is going to challenge U.S. hegemony, then I think you can look at little test cases like this with Hurong and watch it carefully and see how they manage it, because you're talking about a nightmare in the making. Do they make it go away? That which was created to solve other problems, now that it's having its own problems, where does it go? How do they resolve it? How do they assign the losses? Who takes the hit?
Okay, so let's go ahead and unpack this a little bit, because there really are two economies. And, you know, I had mentioned Jim Grant earlier, but Grant has a newsletter called The Interest Rate Observer, and he likes watching the free markets, and he realizes that gold and interest rates actually are the message that the free markets send. So you have the free market, which requires judgment and value judgment to buy and sell. Then you have this market that's been created by, like, the Hurongs out there, and this massive amount of debt, like you said, $60,000 to $80,000 pickup trucks, everybody can drive. Why? Because they can all borrow. So you have economy number one, the value economy, that ultimately has to be funded with real money. Then you have the credit economy, or what I would call, you know, this artificial economy that we've had, especially the last 8 years. And really, value means nothing. Momentum means everything. Algorithms, the quants. I'd like to look at that. Okay, let's look at the points on what's shifted in recent years.
Two things I think stand out to me, things that have worked in recent years, and I think that's likely to change moving forward. In recent years, you've had indexing.
That's that quant economy, right? Indexing. It's passive.
It's a passive way of investing in a particular fund.
Right.
And indexing has been key to success as an investor. And the closer you have been to an index, the better your performance has mm-hmm. been. So this whole period of the last 8 to 10 years, where you've had massive financial interventions by central banks, active money management was not taking you anywhere.
No, you're encouraged to turn your brain off and just invest.
Right. In that same time frame, if you look at some of the best and brightest hedge fund managers, these are the guys that worked for your big Wall Street firms for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and then launched out on their own and created their own hedge funds in their own money management platforms.
These are value guys.
The guys who focused on macro factors that drive prices, whether that's shifts in policy, monetary policy, fiscal policy, event-driven type things, changing relationships politically or geopolitically, anyone who's managing from a macro perspective, all these funds have, in the last 8 to 10 years, underperformed the index. Now, this is fascinating because what worked alongside the indexes were other kinds of hedge funds called quant funds.
You know what? This reminds me of what my wife tells me. She says, Kevin, you're thinking too deeply on this. Stop thinking so deeply. Just do it. And in a way, that's what all of society has been told. Just, you know, if Facebook gaps down, just go buy Facebook. You know it's going to go up. Okay. Or if you are going to invest money and you don't really want to look for value, you just go into an index. Now, quant funds are a little bit different because at that point, you're really just, you're investing in pure mathematics, are you not?
Sure. An algorithm that trades off a set of rules and profits only on the micro oscillations, you know, picking up a penny here, picking up a point there. It was quite something to watch performance improve in many of these quantitative strategies, you know, over the last few years. And then all of a sudden that reverses. But they did so well up until January of this year. Volatility diminishing. Central banks ruling the show.
Mm-hmm.
And quantitative funds, which are just, again, operating within a set of narrow parameters with a very narrow set of rules, with a very limited look at history, financial history, they're making money hand over fist.
Well, they're counting on the central banks creating a platform of stability so that they can trade the tiny little moves. Now, I read something, Dave, that these quant funds, by their own admission, these quants only use about 30 years of data. Now, last week when we were talking on the show, I was saying it hit me that you have an entire generation all the way up into their 50s of people who do not remember having to manage money in a rising interest rate market. Now, these quant funds, okay, so if the central banks are creating an element of stability at almost zero interest rates, and these algorithms, you know, what have you, are trading on that. What happens when you have an anomaly and you actually have something that hasn't happened in the last 30 years, which is a rising interest rate environment?
Right. So you get future financial determinism, which is predicated only on the most recent past. That's really what you're talking about with the quant funds. And so a lot changed in January, and I don't know that many people have made that observation. Investors have taken note that equity prices peaked in January. Volatility was hitting record lows. Both the index ETF craze and the quant outperformance seem to have hit an inflection point in January. And I think the likelihood of a reversal in both of those venues, in both of those popular trends, is very high. A reversal back the other direction. What does that imply? It implies that active money management is preferable in times where value matters.
In other words, turn your brain back on.
I think it's going to be very important over the next 10 years. In the process of determining value, of owning value, it has been out of favor longer, certainly, perhaps than any other time I can recall in financial market history.
Sure.
But I don't think that lasts forever. This circles us back around to the many hours that we've spent discussing interest rates and the central role that rates play in the pricing of risk. And because of that, influencing the judgment of investors on every asset class under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Interest rates have an impact on every asset class under the sun. So if you are tinkering with the rate of interest, you are tinkering with the value of every asset class. And when you stop tinkering, there is a natural consequence into the value of every asset class. The period of time where indexing, where quant investing has flourished, was in fact the period where market signaling and prices as a reflection of value were completely irrelevant, were not relevant,
mm-hmm.
right? So you could work off of a chart, you could work off of a basic trend, a few rules, a few micro factors, as Jim Grant describes them. That was all that was necessary to make money. And the holy grail of investing in the last 10 years has been based on a strange twist on the idea of trust.
Right.
Trust in technological advancement. And the, again, running an algorithm that operates according to a set of rules, that's determined by a set of assumptions, that's informed by a brief glimpse in history.
Yet strange, the almighty index, this turning your brain off and just investing stupid, you know, just invest stupid. In fact, it's sort of crude the way they say it, so I won't say it the way it's said the most often, but it's called buy the dip. And literally, if the market dips at all, you're guaranteed by the central banking community right now to just buy the dip. It really doesn't matter what you buy, as long as it's in the favor of the Wall Street markets.
Something you said last week, Kevin, is you referenced your daughter and sort of the retirement plans that have been proposed to her by her employer. You know, when are you retiring? All right, well, then choose the 2050 plan.
Right.
Choose the 2040 plan, where the year that you're retiring, all of your investments are going to be at a perfect alignment on the day that you retire.
Nobody even knows what's in those investments. They just say, oh, well, it's going to be the right mix for 2040 retirement.
Think of all the assumptions that are packed into that. You're talking about just riding the market. No
yeah.
research, no risk management, no question as to the viability of such an approach, particularly if you have the return of macro factors. Because we've had a 10-year hiatus of macro factors, and it's been the micro that's mattered, where literally you pick up a penny here, you pick up a penny there, and that's what you get to keep at the end of the year. Well, in real terms, interest rates are one of these macro factors that matter. All right, not today, because if you look at treasury yields between 2 and 3% and factor in the rate of inflation, in real terms, they're still at zero.
Right.
So, I mean, in real terms, they aren't a factor yet. But you're talking in nominal terms, they're already a factor. And so 2, 3%, we are at this threshold. That's why last week we were talking about the importance of interest rates, the importance of the 10-year at 3%. You begin to put pressure on an over-leveraged system.
I'll tell you what, though. Do you realize just how lonely you are in the room that you're standing in, Dave? Because what you're talking about is still using your mind for investing, actively managing. What you're talking about is looking for real value, not artificial value. You're also asking the question, what happens when history repeats itself and interest rates actually rise? All of those things you're still asking yourself. And last night I asked you, are we just hopeless romantics sitting here thinking this? Because a lot of the guys who stood in this room with us who would have said, yes, this is how we've made our living all of our lives, they've basically thrown the towel in. They've entered the next room where all the people are. And they're like, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. What we're going to do is we're going to actually start buying and selling. It doesn't matter what the value is. It can be just garbage.
Just write it.
Just write it.
Trade a chart point. There are those, I think, that propose the financial system is so rigged at this point that a serious decline is out of the question.
That's the room I'm talking about.
Yeah,
that's the one that's populated right now.
I mean, I think a few of these people I know quite well, and they've suggested to me on the same basis that, all right, gold is therefore unnecessary in an asset allocation, because while we don't know the future, what we do have is the predictive capacity of algorithms, and that predictive capacity is now so robust that the system can be effectively managed away from crisis, away from price declines. We have a permanent floor in the market, which has been established by the powers that be. This is the argument that they would make,
right,
and I've quite taken exception to it.
This time is different.
This time is different, and therefore there is also a permanent ceiling for gold as well. And I disagree. What I sense is a forced answer to a question that's not ours to answer in the first place. What does the future hold? Fill in the gap.
Yeah, we've talked about this so often. In fact, this is the reason for us to do the commentary. This is the reason for us to read what we read and look at what we do. We can look back at history. We have that available to us. What we don't have available to us is the knowledge of the future. And nothing has to happen in the future based on history. But history is a good predictor of markets, far better than saying this time is different.
Why is that the case? Why is that the case? What does the future hold? No, we can't know it, and you shouldn't pretend to know it. And I think there is a certain degree to which when you put your faith and confidence in an algorithm, you are saying that the future will take care of itself on the basis of these rules, which implies greater knowledge of the future and greater knowledge of the processes into the future than you actually have. But why is history important to us? Because it gives you a caricature of humans and their behaviors and their choices, and those patterns can become probabilistic. And so, no, there is nothing determined about the future, but we can certainly improve our odds by being students of humanity, being students of psychology, being students of sociology, and then, of course, all of the other things that are most relevant to money, which would be economics and finance.
And we also need to be humble. And I think sometimes people think that a person who buys gold is predicting the future, which is just the opposite. You buy gold out of humility for admitting that you can't predict the future. There is a difference. There's an arrogance when you're relying on an algorithm or you're relying on an index. There's an arrogance saying you must know the future. When you buy gold, I know for me, the reason I buy gold and continue to buy gold is because I don't know the future. And I know one thing still, just like that shipwreck, you know, from 110 years ago. If that was my gold under that water, it still has value today.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm planning on spending some time with Jim Grant this fall, and his perspective, I think, is refreshing. He's an interest rate guy. He's a bond guy.
Right.
But he's also a gold bug, which is kind of an interesting coincidence. He says, the future's too interesting to be predictable. It's much too interesting.
Well, I love that quote. The future's too interesting to be predictable.
And he goes on to say that the bullish story on gold is reducible to the single word. Events.
Mm-hmm.
The legacy monetary asset is the armor against adverse monetary and credit events. In our time, he says, it's most particularly the armor against the consequences of adulterated interest rates.
Well, and an interest rate is really just the cost of capital, is it not?
Yeah. So, I mean, in essence, the money mandarins have tried to play games with one of the core components of capitalism, capital, specifically the cost of capital.
Mm-hmm.
Grant comments that interest rates are the most consequential price in capitalism. They're the traffic signals of investment. They're the calibrators of risk. They're the measures of time preference. Right? And he's a great writer. They discount the present value of future cash flows. They define investment hurdle rates. Try to imagine a world without them. And here's the fascinating thing. You don't have to, Kevin, because we've just had 10 years of a world without interest rates, one of the key components to capitalism. And one of the key components to the pricing of all assets. And if you think for a moment that we've lost cyclicality in the market and that it's only a return to Eden from here, because the central planners, whether it's the Chinese or the folks at the Fed, have figured things out this time, who are we kidding?
What you're talking about, when you put interest rates to the side and you no longer actually have that way of monitoring the cost of money, here's what he says. This is a continuation of the quote. He says, lastly, ultra-low rates of interest push and pull. They pull consumption forward. Car loans and mortgage rates invite consumers to spend. They push business failure. You've talked about this often. These zombie companies that should fail, they push these way out into the future. So that failure is still coming, but it's pushed into the future. And he says zombie companies can find credit with which to extend their unnatural lives. Now, when you have this kind of dislocation and distortion in the market, you better be a value investor when things change.
Right. Well, I mean, the quote unquote success. I mean, if you're talking about the ECB, the BOJ, the Fed, the People's Bank of China, your world central bankers.
The providers of Eden.
Right. The guys who are cleaning up the various past credit excesses with even greater credit availability. I mean, this goes back to Kasparov's idea, right? Because what you said about Kasparov, you know, more control being required to maintain control. Mm-hmm. Not only in the supply of credit, because that's what they do is create lots of it, infinite amounts of it, but they also want to influence the distribution and allocation of credit, right? So there is greater degrees of control by the ECB, BOJ, and Fed.
It's like they can promise forever day, no night. Forever day, no night.
And we're left with this idea. I mean, many now think that because of this, there's been an erasure of cyclicality.
Right. No more seasons. No more
erasure of the moves from boom to bust.
Yeah.
That's your virtual Eden.
Well, let's look at China because really they are, as far as what's fueling economic growth worldwide right now, China is a major component. And, you know, if we were sitting here 10 years ago, we would be talking about subprime loans. China really is the harbor of subprime loans at this point.
Last month, we mentioned the percentage that they contributed to GDP, global GDP growth, and they are a far larger contributor than even the U.S. economy. Even though we have the largest economy in the world, they contribute more to global economic growth than we do. So we come back around, we return to China because this is not only the primary contributor to global economic growth, far more than the U.S. at present, but also one of the primary points of concern, the connection points in a world of interconnected finance. You know, so think about what's happened in the last week in Pakistan. Financial collapse on the heels of taking on massive loan programs, much of their loans direct to the Chinese as a part of a financing scheme tied to the One Belt, One Road initiative, right? So they're willing to build up the world, create infrastructure projects. They export Chinese workers to each of those locations. I think they've got deals with like 60, 70 different countries where they're building out infrastructure. They don't hire people in those countries. They send Chinese workers to do this, right? And then they create loans to these people. I mean, it's a really interesting thing because here you have Pakistan, which is now borrower and servant to the lender. China has its own banking issues. They may have to have a restructuring of these loans with Pakistan and with many of their other One Belt, One Road partners. All of this is a fascinating thing. They're trying to expand their reach, grow globally, and use credit to do that. And yet the mechanisms to do it, they're not clean. They're not pure. This is not normal banking. This is not traditional banking. This is actually beyond the outer reaches of anything we've seen in the history of finance.
We were talking about Hurong Asset Management. Okay, that was $4 trillion on their books. But really, the Chinese banking assets equal 10 times that. Isn't it like $40 trillion?
There's kind of a pecking order. You've got ICBC, which is your $4 trillion in assets under management, and then Hurong, which is kind of the garbage bin, if you will, for ICBC and many of the other PBOC initiatives. But the Chinese banking system as a whole, if you're counting all of it, yep, $40 trillion U.S. dollars, the equivalent of 50% of global GDP. For comparison, look at Japan. We know that they went to excess. We know that the credit growth that we saw in Japan in the 1980s, which placed the Royal Palace in downtown Tokyo at a greater monetary value than the entire state of California. I mean, we're talking about pricing, which was absolutely nutty, driven by credit, which was absolutely nutty, and yet it did not even come close to what we have in China today. You know, 2016 alone, Chinese credit grew. It expanded at 16.5%, right? I mean, so we come back to Hurong Asset Management. Not all those loans being pushed out the door are good loans.
Right.
And with the increase in credit and the decrease in prudence in lending comes the increase of risk, the necessity for those SPVs, the special purpose vehicles. And there's a requirement here of running a tighter and tighter ship within the country because things are getting to the outer limits of these credit excesses, right? So when you run a tighter ship, what does that include? Well, in the free world, it does not include the gulag. However,
but
there
in the
is,
controlled world, it does.
Absolutely, up to and including re-education camps. So you've got company managers, they know too much. Maybe they get too greedy. Maybe they don't follow the party line close enough. We're trying to preserve our view of a financial Eden, and we're trying to keep, as investors, this bright and cheery picture of global growth, of U.S. domestic growth, but it's all tied to one very frail system, and it's a system of finance driven by infinite credit creation.
Okay, but when we talked about those two rooms, okay, the room that you're very lonely in right now, which is using your brain, still buying value when nobody cares, and then the other room that's completely packed, you know, I think of quotes going back all through history, Alan Greenspan, Irving Fisher, Larry Kudlow, currently, these guys are all saying that the boom is sustainable. Even your friends, even people that you know really well, Dave, who've said, you know, I'm not going to do it anymore. I can't wait for value to kick back in. I've got to go play the game by the rules that have changed.
You asked the question, is this romanticism? I don't think so. I think this is contrarianism at its best, because here you have the bull to bear ratio. If you're looking at the RIDEX ratios, where you look at the number of dollars that have gone into and been invested in bear funds versus bullish mutual funds. And the ratio today is 24.5 to 1.
Everybody's bullish.
24 times the number of people bullish versus bearish.
24 people in that other room, Dave. There you are alone.
Right. The only time it's been higher, 27 to 1 was the only other higher ratio. Mm. Right. So the contrarian would say, this is setting up perfectly. This is setting up perfectly. You've got confidence in the system at the highest possible levels, and confidence is always at the highest possible levels as the system is at its most dangerous point. So, yeah, Larry Kudlow, he ends up echoing here in recent weeks, Alan Greenspan back in 1973, Irving Fisher back in 1929. Kudlow says this is a boom that will be sustainable. Frankly, as far as the eye can see, this is no one shot ever. And then you've got Steve Mnuchin, who's, again, sort of, he's joined the choir. I don't think, he says, I don't think this is a 1 or 2 year phenomenon. I think we definitely are in a period of 4 or 5 years of sustained growth at least. And then Trump's with his what? His expectation of economic growth of 8-9% annually here in the United States. Okay. While that's possible, let's bear in mind that the prevailing sentiment, which is very positive today, it can flip on a dime.
Mm-hmm.
It can flip on a dime. If you go back to the newsreels of the first 2 weeks of February, everybody's changing their diapers because sentiment was super positive in the third and fourth week of January, and then everybody's confused. What just happened? Why is the market down 10%? We don't understand. Everything's so... And there's confusion and chaos. And the financial markets, this is where I think we've got the key. The financial markets hold the key. Rising inflation, rising rates, and a world with too many debt obligations. These are the essential ingredients for cyclicality.
Right.
And these ingredients, they fly in the face of those that hold to this idea that you can indefinitely manage financial market environments towards some sort of a Shangri-La. Right? The opposite. These are pro-cyclical factors we're talking about, things that make the future outcomes far more exaggerated and not for the good. What are we dealing with today? We're dealing with the residue of aggressive monetary policy on a global basis. You couple that with very aggressive fiscal policy on a global basis. You meet with a very tight labor market. Are we going to have surprises for a variety of asset classes that have assumed that we're going to see low rates forever? Absolutely.
Well, could we see, though, that the markets, even subconsciously, are starting to sense that there's a problem? You know, copper, housing, that type of thing would normally be booming if what Trump was talking about, 8-9% growth rates, we would see copper skyrocketing. We would see housing skyrocketing.
We brought this up in June and July.
Home builders, anyway.
Yeah. This is important because, you know, for all the discussion of economic growth, Dr. Copper doesn't lie. And I'm not saying that there isn't economic growth. There is. But you've got economic statistics which are backward looking. This is really important. If you're looking at an economic statistic, it is reporting aggregated data up to that point, and it's rear view, baby. when you're looking at prices of assets, that is trying to anticipate the future and what supply and demand will be. So when you see a divergence between economic statistics, which are backward-looking, and asset prices, which are forward-looking, I think you ought to pay attention to what is forward-looking, if you care about what the future may hold. So, yeah, home builders and copper, what did they tell you about the future growth here in the United States? I think they tell you a lot. Take any time at all to look at a chart of copper, to look at a chart of the home builders. You know, in what historical context did you have sustained economic growth without these asset classes blowing off the roof? What we appear to have is the markets, I think you're right, they're already anticipating troubles ahead. Yes, we have positive economic statistics, but they lag financial market reality. And I think financial market reality is in that anticipation mode as we speak.
Every year, the powers that be, the titans of the universe, the central bankers, meet at Jackson Hole. Now, what do you think they're talking about this August? You know, as far as continuing to keep this stable structure alive and allow the indexing and the algorithmic types of programs to continue to work for more.
Yep, they've announced their title for the gathering this year, what their focus is going to be, and it's changing market structure and implications for monetary policy. Changing market structure and implications for monetary policy.
So it's not the same market structure and implications for monetary policy. They're actually saying something's changing.
Right. Well, to my mind, it should read the inverse. If they were for a moment self-reflective, if they were for a moment self-critical, it should be implications of monetary policy fundamentally changing market structure.
Oh, there's the cart horse thing, yeah.
Yeah, because it's not as if they're reacting to a changing market structure. They changed the market structure because of their policies. When we talk about indexing, when we talk about the drive towards quant funds clipping for pennies and points here and there, what we're talking about is projects that only work in the context where fundamentals don't matter, value doesn't matter, a thoughtful investment process doesn't matter because you have a permanent floor in the asset price market.
By the way, you know, the story that I had read or listened to last week, and I couldn't remember the name, it was called The Pedestrian by Ray Bradbury. And that was the story where society in 2050 had gotten everybody to be just completely passive in every way. And this one man who was a pedestrian who still walked outside in the evenings was picked up by the police. And I likened that to the markets and to this passive structure. You know, Financial Times did an article on August 2nd and quoted, it said a fundamental shift in the market structure toward rules-based passive investing over the past decade means a lot of trading is no longer based on fundamentals. This is exactly what you're saying, Dave. It says this shift in market structure could well be a trigger for the next global downturn. That's the Financial Times.
When I mentioned the permanent floor, I don't mean permanent floor. It's a permanent floor until you discover the trapdoor.
Right.
I mean, it's well supported until there's nothing underneath you. And it is a Wile E. Coyote moment. So yeah, the article suggests that there's been a change in market structure because of what they've done. And I agree with that. The proximate cause of all our financial crises has been central planning and banking activism. And I will grant them positive intentions, well-intentioned behavior. I mean, when we talk to Carmen Reinhart and others in the central bank community, these are not mean people. These are not vitriolic people. These are not people of a diabolical priority. They're just trying to make a better world. And they're working off of assumptions and off of theses, which they've studied in their PhD programs, which support the kinds of policies that they promote.
And that's theses with a TH, right? Not an F.
My kids would be joking about that if they.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so well-intentioned as they may be, ultimately it's disastrous in its results. But even recent history, as recent as 08 and 09 is easy to forget because people continue to forget the past. And I think this is one of the prudent reasons. This is one of the primary reasons. This is one of the essential reasons to own gold. People forget the past.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.